Today is Tuesday, May 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. New Zealand pushes back on China.
We've got to stand up for ourselves. And, you know, true friendship is based on equality.
Plus, three cases are being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Lawyers for the U.S. House of Representatives and New York State want to see the president's financial records.
Versus the claims by the president and his lawyers that the president shouldn't be bothered and hampered.
And can the travel industry survive the pandemic? Those stories and more next. In an effort to prevent importing new cases of the coronavirus, Spain is requiring people arriving from abroad to go into quarantine for 2 weeks. The country has started to emerge from a 7-week strict lockdown after explosion of cases made it one of the world's COVID-19 hotspots. A health ministry order published on Tuesday said the quarantine rules will go into effect on Friday and will apply to both visitors from other countries as well as Spanish citizens who are returning home. People will be allowed only to go to grocery stores or to seek medical care during that 14-day period. China instituted a similar strategy as it saw its locally transmitted cases sharply decline and authorities began easing lockdown restrictions. Governments all over the world are currently weighing their strategies and whether it is time to impose new measures to stop the spread of the virus or allow people to resume parts of their normal lives. Globally, there are about 4.2 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, with over 286,000 deaths attributed to the coronavirus. In Singapore, Tuesday brought a new phase of reopening, with people allowed to get a haircut, visit bakeries, or go to laundry shops. India is resuming some train service today for the first time since March. Passengers must pass temperature checks and adhere to social distancing guidelines. South Korean authorities are worried about a resurgence of cases and are working to track down people who recently visited nightclubs in Seoul, where a cluster of new infections has emerged. Officials said Tuesday teams of South Korea are using phone and credit card data to try and track down about 2,000 more people so they can be tested. So far, there are more than 100 confirmed cases linked to nightclubs in the country. There's additional information available on our website, voanews.com. New Zealand's foreign minister said the country has to stand up for itself after China warned its backing of Taiwan's participation at the World Health Organization could damage bilateral ties. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has pushed back at China, who warned that New Zealand's backing of Taiwan's participation at the WHO could damage bilateral ties. At a press conference on Tuesday, Ardern reiterated her government's support for the One China principle, which refers to the policy that there is only one Chinese government. Taiwan is excluded from the WHO due to the objections of China, which views the island as one of its provinces.
Through a number of years, we've always taken a one China policy, and that is continues to be the case. The world learnt a lot from China's response. Their use of a lockdown in Wuhan demonstrated the ability to control the spread of the virus in a way that probably saved a large number of lives. Equally, a place like Taiwan has used some particular approaches that have demonstrated also success in their management.
Last week, senior ministers in New Zealand said Taiwan should be allowed to join the WHO as an observer, given its success in controlling the global health crisis. On Tuesday, New Zealand's foreign minister, Winston Peters, also praised Taiwan's response and said he did not think the issue should harm diplomatic ties with China, New Zealand's biggest trading partner.
We've got to stand up for ourselves. And, you know, true friendship is based on equality. It's based on the ability to, in this friendship, nevertheless disagree. All we are saying is, and having looked very carefully around the world, to find examples of how we might help internationally and locally our defeat of COVID-19, Taiwan has been a standout society.
In a statement, Taiwan's foreign ministry expressed thanks for New Zealand's support and expressed regret at China's threats against New Zealand.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. The Australian state of Victoria is to ease some of its COVID-19 restrictions today as other jurisdictions wind back disease control measures. Phil Mercer has more.
Victoria, the second most populous state, has some of Australia's strictest lockdown measures. The state government has announced a small first step in the relaxation of its COVID-19 restrictions. Sport and recreation is allowed in groups of up to 10 people. Hiking, fishing and hunting will also be permitted from late Tuesday, but physical distancing and hygiene measures will stay in place. Larger groups are also allowed to attend weddings and funerals. Residents can now have 5 people to their homes as guests. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews is urging a cautious approach.
Whilst it is now allowed for you to go and have dinner or a visit with family and friends, that doesn't mean, and it is not an invitation, to be having a dinner party at every house every night.
Cafes and restaurants in Victoria will still be only allowed to sell takeout meals and drinks, while schools are expected to resume in the next 4 weeks. Students in New South Wales State have already started a phased return to the classroom and will return initially to classes for 1 day a week. On Friday, the Northern Territory will reopen bars. State authorities in South Australia are allowing regional travel and outdoor dining. As the curbs are gradually eased, health authorities across Australia are warning that the greatest risk of more coronavirus infections is complacency. Australia's federal budget was due to be released Tuesday, but was delayed because of the pandemic. It's been delayed until October, and the government is forecasting the coronavirus crisis has inflicted the biggest financial deficit in Australian history. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Donald Trump abruptly ended his White House briefing Monday night. The AP's Tim McGuire reports.
During his briefing on the coronavirus outbreak, President Trump was asked by Weijia Jiang of CBS why he seems to see the coronavirus pandemic as a global competition as people are dying.
Maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question.
Her response.
What, sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you. I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
like
that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Trump then brushed off CNN's Caitlin Collins.
Sorry, I just wanted to.
The young lady in the back, please.
I just wanted to let my colleague finish, but can I ask you?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
The AP's Sagar Morghani adds that the White House itself has become a microcosm of the challenges Americans are facing to try and avoid a further coronavirus spread. Plus, administration coronavirus experts are set to testify before the Senate later today.
Despite the massive security, access to rapid testing, temperature checks, and the like, the virus has still made it into the White House, which President Trump is shrugging off.
We have a lot of people in the White House, and we had one. Basically, we had one person.
Actually, two. Anybody entering the West Wing is only now being required to wear masks or face coverings. The president said for weeks he won't wear one.
I'm very far away from everyone.
And is again touting America's testing capability.
We have met the moment, and we have prevailed.
First, insisting all Americans can get a test, and then amending it.
If people want to get tested, they get tested. But for the most part, they shouldn't want to get tested.
Though there's still not enough capacity for that to actually happen for average Americans going back to work. Some of the nation's leading scientists will testify before a Senate panel today while under quarantine due to coronavirus concerns. The hearing's titled Safely Getting Back to Work and Back to School. In a sign of the times, three of the witnesses will testify remotely. Dr. Anthony Fauci, CDC Director Robert Redfield, and FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn are all in self-quarantine, as is panel chairman Lamar Alexander. It's the first time Fauci will appear before a congressional panel since early March.
Things will get worse than they are right now.
The White House blocked Fauci from appearing before a Democratic-led House committee last week. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says this isn't a White House briefing. President Trump isn't lurking nearby.
Dr. Fauci, let it rip.
Sagar Morghani, Washington.
Oliver Ridley turtle hatchings have been crossing the Rishikulya beach in India during the daytime. That is something only made possible because the beach has been abandoned due to the coronavirus pandemic. Reuters' David Doyle shares this story.
In the morning light on India's eastern coast, millions of endangered baby turtles are making their way to sea. That this can be seen in the daytime is something made possible by lockdown measures, which have left this stretch of coast in a Odisha state largely deserted. Rishikulya Beach is one of the few places in the world where the olive ridley turtles come to lay eggs during late winter and the beginning of spring each year. The mothers come during nighttime and bury the eggs in sand nests, and after around 45 days, the hatchlings emerge and are returned to the sea. This year, a lack of footfall at beaches and boat movements in the sea means the phenomenon can be witnessed during daytime. The latest example of wildlife reclaiming territory or flourishing seen worldwide over the past few weeks.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. And coming up later...
I think it's going to be forever changed, to be honest with you. The United States Travel Association recently put out guidelines for what the industry should do to build public confidence.
This is VOA News.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. Supreme Court will hold today a virtual session and begin considering efforts by the Democratic-led House of Representatives and a grand jury working with a prosecutor in New York City to obtain copies of U.S. President Donald Trump's financial records. Unlike recent presidents, Mr. Trump has refused to disclose his tax returns and other materials that would shed light on the scope of his wealth and his family-run real estate business. Earlier, I spoke with Villanova University law professor Michael Moreland via Skype to get a better idea of what each side plans to argue and what a potential outcome could mean for the three branches of government.
Well, three cases. Two of them involve subpoenas from committees of the House of Representatives that are seeking to investigate the president and his family, and for that purpose are trying to secure the tax records and financial records from the Trumps. And then another one involves an action by the Manhattan District Attorney. And so in all of them, it's a collision between, on the one hand, the arguments on behalf of the Manhattan District Attorney and the House of Representatives committees that they're entitled to this information, that it's part of their legitimate oversight and investigative process, versus the claims by the president and his lawyers that the president shouldn't be bothered and hampered, as it were, by this kind of, in their view, meddlesome, intrusive action by these actors.
Have there been any analogous cases in previous case law that kind of sets this up?
Well, the most famous one by far is United States versus Nixon, which involved the question of whether or not there could be a subpoena issued to against President Nixon during the Watergate crisis. And in that case, the Supreme Court did hold that the president was subject to subpoena power. And so that's the precedent most friendly to the House of Representatives here. On the other side, though, are a set of, I'd say, more kind of customary arguments and arguments about the ways in which the presidency has what we call executive privilege or other kinds of ways of avoiding this kind of investigation.
This is, of course, regarding the current occupant of the White House. This is an election year. What could potentially come about from this, since, you know, oral arguments are May 12th, but the decision won't come for some time?
Well, we expect the decision will at least come by the end of the Supreme Court's current term, which will be very end of June, beginning of July at the latest. And at that point, then, if the House is successful, for example, you can imagine the president having to comply with that subpoena, and then seeing what political hay the House committees can make out of that in the reelection campaign of the president.
And if the White House is successful?
Well, if the White House is successful, then that's the end of the cases for now. That you can imagine there might be other efforts down the road, including when the president leaves office, whenever that is, to continue this kind of investigation, either in a congressional or criminal vein. But at least for now, it would establish a fairly broad principle of presidential immunity from certain kinds of these kinds of subpoenas.
In terms of quote unquote presidential immunity, is there anything within the Constitution that lays out that kind of doctrine?
Well, that's certainly what the president's lawyers and the Department of Justice in this case are arguing, namely that as to the president himself and the way they have a structural argument based on the Constitution, that because the president is set up by the Constitution itself, that it gives the president some measure of immunity from this kind of congressional oversight and intrusion. Interestingly, the court also recently asked for the parties to offer supplemental briefing on a question of whether or not this kind of case is even justiciable, which is the sort of fancy word for saying that whether the courts can weigh in on this kind of interbranch dispute between Congress and the president. Interestingly, though, both the House committees and the president's lawyers took the position that, yes, this dispute is justiciable and they want the Supreme Court to resolve it one way or the other.
Would the Supreme Court still have the option of ruling that it's not?
They would. I mean, the Supreme Court could decide on its own, notwithstanding the fact that the parties have urged it to decide the case one way or the other. The court could decide that this falls into what we call the political question doctrine. That is to say that these are disputes about the power of congressional committee to subpoena the president in this kind of instance that have been committed by the Constitution to the political branches, that is to say to Congress and the president, to basically kind of fight it out between them, and that the courts have to stay out of those kinds of political disputes. Again, the parties haven't asked for that, but the court interestingly did ask about it, which might indicate some interest in their part on avoiding the dispute.
Michael Moreland is a law professor at Villanova University in the state of Pennsylvania. Gunmen stormed a maternity hospital in the western part of Kabul Tuesday, setting off a shootout with the police, killing at least 14 people as Afghan forces carried out babies and their mothers to evacuate the facility under fire. Two babies are among the dead. A suicide bomber in northeastern Nangarhar province targeted a funeral ceremony, killing more than 20 people and wounding at least 40. Also on Tuesday, a bomb planted in a cart in a market in eastern Coast province killed a child and wounded 10 people. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack in Kabul, where both the Taliban and the IS frequently target Afghan military and security forces, as well as civilians. Turkey is accusing Greece, Cyprus, Egypt, France, and the United Arab Emirates of seeking an alliance of evil after those countries jointly denounce Ankara's policies in the Eastern Mediterranean and Libya. The foreign ministers of the five countries held a teleconference Monday to discuss the situation in the Eastern Mediterranean, where Turkey has been drilling for potential hydrocarbon deposits in an offshore area where Cyprus has exclusive economic rights, as well as the situation in Libya. Yemeni officials say fierce clashes have erupted in the southern province of Abyan between Saudi-backed government troops and separatists backed by the United Arab Emirates. At least six fighters from both sides have been killed during the past 24 hours. The clashes come amid weeks of mounting tensions after the secessionist Southern Transitional Council last month declared self-rule over the key port city of Aden to assert control over southern Yemen. With planes sitting on tarmacs, empty hotels, and citizens worldwide staying home, the pandemic is having a catastrophic impact with the travel industry, a major contributor to the global economy. International Edition's Lori London asked Pauline Frommer, editorial director of Frommer's Guidebooks and Frommer's.com, if this expansive industry can survive.
I
think it's going to be forever changed, to be honest with you. The United States Travel Association recently put out guidelines for what the industry should do to build public confidence. And I sat in on the meeting where they announced these guidelines and took questions. And they happened to mention in passing that a third of all hospitality jobs in the United States have been lost, gone, vanished. Thousands, tens of thousands of people. So I think travel will be different. I think it will be less carefree for a couple of years. There's an organization that does business-to-business research, and they did a poll and found that within the next 6 months to a year, most Americans are going to confine their travels to road trips no longer than 100 miles from their homes. So I think that there's a bit of a fear of travel. Now, on the flip side of that, I remember after 9/11, during that week when nobody was traveling because the skies were closed, everybody was saying travel will never get back. It seemed very dark. And yet we did. Mm. So part of me thinks, am I just being an Eeyore, right, or am I being realistic?
We're hearing about even some of these very large airlines not sure they can survive, much less all these other parts of the industry.
And Norwegian Cruise Lines has warned that it will probably have to file for bankruptcy and may not make it even with that. Mm. So, yeah, it's a dire situation for those in the travel industry. The industry is suffering perhaps more than any other, and it's such a large industry. People think of travel as a trivial pursuit, but it really is something that keeps millions of people working. There are estimates that one out of 11 human beings on this planet works in travel in some fashion.
It's obviously a big part of the economy, in the world economy.
Absolutely.
What about people that love to travel that have never even thought that it would be an issue that they couldn't, but they're really itching to get out, particularly Americans, where this pandemic is still to some degree raging. Even if the government wants to reopen, the world might not be ready for us.
Yeah, we wrote an article on Fromers.com, our website, with the headline American Pariah. Unfortunately, because the response to this pandemic has been so chaotic compared with other Western nations, and because of the lack of testing, we have the most cases per capita in the world, and we also have the least knowledge of who has it and who doesn't. Just as we closed our borders to China when they were the hot spot, I am very worried that for a long time, Americans will not be welcome in other parts of the world because the world will not have a way of knowing if we're okay. A bunch of countries in Europe have announced their reopening plans, and most of them, like France and Ireland, probably won't be open to any visitors outside of those from the European Union until late July. Greece said they're going to do it earlier in June, but they want travelers to show some kind of certificate to show that they have the antibodies for the virus, which is something the World Health Organization would not approve of because they are saying there's not enough scientific knowledge to say that if you have the antibodies, you can't be a carrier, you can't get it again. So the science isn't backing what Greece wants to do. And we have nothing in place here in the United States to even begin to tackle that. I actually think it's smarter to buy a ticket now and have that uncertainty than wait and buy it later, because the airline CEOs have been having calls with their investors recently, and they have been telling them to build public confidence. They are going to only sell half of the seats on the planes so that there will be room on each plane for social distancing. But that's an expensive thing to do. So they have said, without mincing their words, that they expect airfares to rise 50% or more to allow them to only sell half the plane. So if you buy your ticket now, yeah, you might have to change the ticket. Your route might get changed. You might have to do a layover in a city you weren't expecting to, but you'll pay far less, I am predicting, than you would by buying your tickets later.
Sort of a confusing time, different than 9/11, where people were just afraid to fly, whereas countries, they want to open, they want the business, they want people to come. At the same time, they don't want to bring people in that are going to spread the virus and have this start all over again.
Right. Right. It's going to be an interesting time. I mean, a lot will depend on when the vaccine can be made. A lot will depend on whether the science can prove that if you have antibodies, you're then safe. The country of Chile is betting on that. They're actually issuing immunity passports to allow people to return to daily life and to travel, which is one of the reasons the World Health Organization said, whoa, wait, right. Science right. isn't there yet.
Pauline Frommer is the editorial director of Frommer's. She was speaking to our own Lori London. You've been listening to International Edition here on The Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.